Hi, welcome to Light Camera Author. I'm Jim Juno, and I have with me today co-authors of a new book. It's by Running Press, our friends over at Turner Classic Movies, and it's called From the Moment They Met, It Was Murder, Double Indemnity, and the Rise of Film Noir. James Ursini and Alan Silver, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Now, this book for those of you who are old movie fanatics like I am, Double Indemnity is one of the best and most famous films of all time, one thing, but also one of the best known examples of film noir. And what surprised me from reading your book, and I didn't realize this, is that it had its roots in true crime in the United States, with I want to, if I can remember her name now, Ruth Snyder.
Ruth Snyder.
Ruth Snyder. And for those of you who aren't aware, Ruth Snyder, she was, I believe, the first woman executed in New York by electric
Second.
chair. Second, okay. And there's a very, very famous photo of her, which was taken at the time of the electrocution in the electric chair. But that's how this whole movie got started, wasn't it?
Yes, pretty much. The first chapter of the book is about true crime, mostly this one. And while it's not really certain that James Caine attended a trial, and in the book we imagine what might have happened if he attended the execution and met the young man who took the picture. But clearly Caine knew about it. It was something you could not miss if you lived in New York in the spring of 1927, because it was front page of every newspaper, not just the tabloids. And Caine was working human interest for the Herald. He was certainly well aware of the crime, pretty much not just the United States, but it had worldwide coverage. It was a sensation. A lot of people don't really understand that the concept of a crime of the century goes back long before crimes of the 21st century. And in the book, we talk about the fact that arguably this is the seventh crime of the century in 1927. There were quite a few, and a lot of them were turned into movies, not all of them via a fiction. Like the one that Caine created when he did the novella.
That's right. And Caine, and James Caine, for those of you who are not aware of this, again, I'm going to educate some people. He was the one who wrote the, you said, a novella, Double Indemnity, which was serialized in what magazine was it?
Liberty.
Liberty Magazine. That's right. Yeah. And that's really what was the basis that became the movie. But we're getting ahead of ourselves with the movie because Caine, first off, he was offered, I believe, what, 25 or $25,000 back in 1927 or 28 for
No. That's too early.
too early
27,
30.
28 is the time of the trial of Ruth Snyder.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So he was he wrote Double Indemnity in
35,
30s. Yeah. Yeah.
1935. Yes.
So he was
But
offered that money originally by the studio MGM, but it never deal never went through because of censorship. The Breen office, which was the production code office, which was coming into its power then, the sort of the American censors, they decided that this was just too sordid and set a bad example for people, would lead other people to like commit murders and murder their husband or all kinds of reasons. And so they reneged on their agreement. They never had official agreement. And then all the other studios had interest to pull back too. So it wasn't until 1943 when Paramount, because of Billy Wilder's interest in it, Billy Wilder had known Caine when they were both writers in Hollywood. around the same time, sort of script doctors fixing up scripts when Wilder first came over here from Germany. He wanted to make this movie and convinced Paramount to purchase it. But the purchase price had come way down by then. And Kane sort of held a grievance against Breen until the end of his life about losing all this money. Because, you know, if that amount of money in the 1930s, 1940s is significantly more than it sounds like today, if you factor in inflation.
It was around $600,000 in today's money.
That's how much he lost?
Well, he eventually did get something, but he never got the 25. He got 15.
Right.
And as James is suggesting, he believed that Breen owed him $10,000 for the rest of his life.
And he's got a case. I mean, because Breen was not going to let anything sordid, in his opinion, or in the opinion of the Hays Code, I'll say that. Can't have that on the screen. You got to have separate beds. You got to have 1 foot on the floor at all times. You can't have a kiss longer than 3 seconds, I believe. Such archaic rules nowadays. But in Double Indemnity, the novella, I don't want to give away the ending, but the ending in the novella is different than the ending in the movie.
Yeah, significantly. Kane was a crime fiction writer, but he was also sort of he was in love with opera, and he sort of had this operatic side. He wanted to become an opera singer, and his mother was an opera singer for a time. And so the ending is very operatic, and sort of surreal, where I don't know. You don't want me to give the ending of the novel away. It ends up on a cruise ship, and it makes references to things like The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Coleridge, and it's just very surreal. So Kane incorporated this often into his hard-bitten crime fiction. So there was Raymond Chandler, who was hired to do the script, the mystery writer. When they sat down to get, he sat together with Billy Wilder, they just realized that this is something that no one would accept. They might accept it today. Audiences are much more amenable to surreal things and melodramatic scenes and so forth, as we see in movies today. But in 1944, that would have been an impossibility. So yeah, the ending is significantly different.
Yeah. And Billy Wilder, you mentioned him. You know, he coming over from Germany. There was actually film noir before Double Indemnity, but that actually came across from the filmmakers that came from Europe brought that over to America, didn't they?
Well, I think that probably a lot of your listeners are aware that before World War II started, shortly after Hitler's rise to power, a lot of people left Europe. First, they left Germany, as did Wilder, who went to Paris. And then when it became clear that there wasn't much of a future in Europe with the threat of Nazism, they went elsewhere, mostly to America, if they were filmmakers. So there were a considerable number of them by the time World War II started, already established at the various studios in their technical capacities. A lot of cinematographers, the composer of Double Indemnity, Miklos Rocha, another emigre. There were four or five others who worked on the movie who all came out of European cinema and made their way to the United States before the start of the war.
So they brought the look of the German. I don't want to just say it's German, but it's German in Paris and that in Austria. They brought the look, the feel over to them. But there was a cinematographer who was responsible for a lot of the look of Double Indemnity. His name was the John Seitz, I believe the name was.
Yes.
And
Well, Seitz was American, but Seitz had worked in the silent era for a filmmaker in the south of France, Rex Ingram, who did projects, fairly large scale projects for MGM. A couple of them with Valentino, maybe the best known being Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. So Seitz had experience in Europe, but he was an American.
yeah, and his he developed this style, which is sometimes called the Rembrandt style, sometimes called chiaroscuro. I interviewed Seitz towards the end of his life, many decades ago, and he developed it working for Ingram, and it's this shadowy lighting that you see also in German Expressionist films like Metropolis or the F.W. Murnau's
Sunrise?
Nosferatu,
Oh, Nosferatu.
also Sunrise. Yeah, Sunrise too. But he developed that, and he kept he they used it to great effect in Double Indemnity, and so he also made several other important film noirs after that, particularly Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard. So yeah, he was an important influence on the movie itself in getting the look, the what was called the you know what was called now the noir look. Obviously, that term didn't exist till the French coined it 3 or 4 years later. But yeah, he was an important influence on the movie.
Now we mentioned Wilder and the writer oh gosh, help me here.
Chandler,
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 Raymond
Raymond Chandler.
Chandler. I went blank there for a second. When you get old, that happens, you know. So
Yep.
the thing, they did not get along. and I was reading in your book, and I mean, I know that Wilder had to, I think he actually had to apologize to him at one point.
He did, yes. Well, I think what most people don't understand about the Hollywood system, especially at that time, it didn't require writers who were working together to get along. And in many cases, they didn't. I mean, if you read Charles Brackett, who collaborated on many pictures with Wilder, the only exception over a period of a decade, more than a decade, was this one. Double Indemnity. If you read Brackett's diaries, and we cite them very often in the book, or Wilder's comments both then and later about Brackett, they admired each other as writers. They did actually occasionally socialize. They were from very different backgrounds and had very different attitudes. What Wilder encountered with Raymond Chandler was someone who wasn't terribly flexible, mostly because, as we detail in the book, when we introduce Chandler up to the point of his collaboration starting, you have to imagine somebody who had switched careers many times. The last career switch was involuntary. He was an alcoholic. He was fired from a very high-paying job with a local oil company. And he was 44 years old at the time and had to reinvent himself, finally went back to writing, and slowly had built up a reputation as a mystery writer. He'd taken a bunch of his short stories, put them together, and made a couple of novels. And at the time he was hired, he had become famous because hundreds of thousands of paperbacks of his novels were printed and distributed free to servicemen. But he still hadn't made much money. He'd never gotten back to the $10,000 a year, and that was a lot of money when he was fired from the oil company per year. So you sort of have to imagine a very well-known best-selling novelist who can still barely afford the rent. And he didn't really have a choice when he was offered this job. Yeah, he could have turned it down, but if if we gave you numbers, they wouldn't sound like much today, but it was too much money for Chandler to pass up. So he felt compelled. At the same time, he really did prefer working alone. And one of the interesting things that we discovered that is detailed in the book is what Chandler did initially on his own. It's really impossible to determine his exact start date. There are records, but it seems as if what happened was that Chandler did a couple of drafts of test scenes before he started working with Wally. And what we determined is a substantial portion of that first scene that Chandler wrote is literally in the movie. And what's interesting there is what he'd already done to Kane. It took a while for them to determine, by them I mean Chandler and Wilder. Chandler realized it sooner, that Kane's dialogue worked okay in a novel, but it really wasn't going to work in the movie. And what Chandler brought was a different approach to the dialogue, to essentially the interaction between the characters than Kane had. And that's kind of what drove the script and the movie. And it came out of a somewhat contentious collaboration. But the thing that's notable is that Wilder kept Chandler on for the shoot. This was not normal for contract writers at a Hollywood studio at that time. And essentially, they did continue to collaborate until at the end of shooting. Chandler was on payroll for that movie until the last day of the next last day of principal photography.
It's from what you were telling me, it sounds like parts of it. I see in Wilder's next movie, The Lost Weekend, with with Ray Milland, with the writer, he's barely scraping things by and alcoholic. I see some aspects of Raymond Chandler's story in that character.
Well, Wilder did say as much later in his in later interviews that Chandler being an alcoholic was part of the approach that he took to depicting an alcoholic in Lost Weekend.
But this is also based on a best-selling novel that dealt with the alcoholic. So it wasn't like he did this full cloth from his experience with Chandler. It probably was like an inspiration in maybe setting up scenes or deciding what to do and what emphasis to make. But it most likely had an influence on. Lost Weekend, yeah.
Now Wilder, it was Wilder's job to try to get the stars, and that wasn't an easy job either. I mean, even the star, the eventual star, didn't want to appear in it. I mean, Fred McMurray was played a nice guy in most movies, and he, he really didn't know if he could play a heel. Neither did Barbara Stanwyck, for that matter. Didn't know if she could play a killer.
Yeah, well, that's what makes it so interesting is that everybody played in a way against type, even Edward G. Robinson to some degree. Edward G. Robinson probably less, because Edward G. Robinson he didn't just play gangsters. He also made straight dramatic films too at Warner Brothers, where he wasn't always the vicious gangster. But all of them, Wilder had to use all of his techniques, which he had many, of convincing people to do things, persistence and like tracking them down and, taunting them. The famous thing where Barbara Stanwyck didn't want to do it, and he said, "Are you an actress or are you a mouse?" A lot of these stories, you have to realize that Wilder tells. He tells many stories over many years, and they change around and around. And so, it's all apocryphal to some degree. You don't know exactly which is true, but it is true that she didn't want to do it. And same thing with McMurray. You're right. He was a comedy actor, you know, or light drama, and was afraid to kill to be portrayed as a killer, which is ironic because for the rest of his career, he sort of searched for these type of parts because he was so praised for what he did in that movie, and always considered one of his best performances. And once in a while, he would find that dark character, like in Pushover with Kim Novak, or the Caine Mutiny,
Oh yeah.
or most importantly, The Apartment with Billy Wilder, where he plays a sort of sleazy boss at a corporation business. So he found them here and there, but mostly he went for the money, you know, working for Disney and the Flubber series, and you know,
My Three
My Three
Sons.
Sons. Yeah, he became the American dad, you know. So yeah.
Interestingly, when he did My Three Sons, this is something we put in the book, but McMurray insisted that the entire season be scripted and all his scenes be shot first, so that he could spend the preponderance of the shooting season at his home in Palm Springs. But the other thing we do mention is that he was, even at the time of Double Indemnity, already quite a successful real estate investor. And he didn't really need to work in movies anymore by that time, but he did. And so after Double Indemnity, while his career arc didn't completely change, as James just said, he really would have wanted to do a part like Walter Never Again. And he only had three or four opportunities in mostly in noir and also in The Apartment.
That's right. Yeah, because I mean, he was a nice guy. That's what he was at. He couldn't break that mold. How
And of
did?
course, Stanwyck also, you know, in a which we quote in the book, a letter to she wrote to James Caine. She praised him for creating that character, and said she would love to do that character again. You know, and in later years, when in her biography, she said, or autobiographies and biographies, she says that the thing that people always ask her about, even in her old age, when she was. And you know, was famous for things like The Big Valley and all that. They would always ask her about Double Indemnity. So she knew that, and it changed her career to some degree also. She'd played tough dames before, you know, like Ball of Fire or back in Babyface in the early 30s, pre-code movie. But she had never played someone as hard as this, as tough as this. But if you notice what happened to her after that, she began to play more and more of those parts of really tough dames, you know. So it changed her career, the trajectory of her career significantly.
And the movie itself, it changed a lot of ways how movies were made, because I mean the way they were shot, the way they appeared, the Venetian blind effect. I think that was the first time it ever it that was a lighting effect that was used in the movie.
Well, that's the sights. That's that chiaroscuro Rembrandt lighting that we were talking about. That's a classic for noir. I mean, that became used over and over and over again. It had been used before, particularly in German Expressionism films in the 20s and 30s. But you're right in that it wasn't extensively used, but became more and more extensive as more and more film noirs were made after the success of Double Indemnity created an opening for all of these noirs to be made at major studios and minor studios.
Wasn't it you mentioned in your book, I want to say it was not Romancing the Stone, was it Romancing? No, Body Heat. That's what, that borrowed some from a Double Indemnity.
It did hard extensively for Double Indemnity.
I was trying to be generous,
Well, it's not a straight remake or homage, obviously, but I think the perspective one should take with a movie made that far afterwards, well, there's two things to draw from it. One, the influence that the noir movement, which had a classic period that generally defined from Maltese Falcon in 41, The Touch of Evil in 58. There are some earlier movies that were noir, and there's a few later movies into the mid-60s, say. But really, by the middle of the 60s, the noir movement was over, and the next generation of filmmakers, a lot of them grew up on this kind of movie. And so when they got the opportunity to express themselves as writer-directors, people like Lawrence Kasdan explicitly took noir subject matter and recast it as neo-noir, which continues to this day. What's interesting, I think, about Body Heat is that it takes the concept of this kind of crime one step further. Really, even though Wilder Chandler wrote a script and the actors gave performances that encouraged the audiences to identify with them, even though they are criminals, their success or failure at that time was governed by the code. In 1980, those restrictions were gone. You could pretty much do whatever you wanted. And that liberated Kasdan in terms of what he could do with the concept and the irony he could impose on the idea of betrayal that's in Double Indemnity. Because we had mentioned, but it's obviously discussed in the book, Kane actually wrote two works of fiction inspired by Rue Schneider and Judd Gray. Not just Double Indemnity, which was one aspect of their crime, but The Postman Always Rings Twice. A similar plot, but the key to that is that they turn on each other, as did Ruth and Judd during their trial. And in both of those original adaptations from the 40s, there was still a code to limit, ultimately, what you could do. Nowadays, there is.
I tell you what, we could go on for another half hour here, but we're out of time. And but I really appreciate both of you. Alan Silver and James Ursini are the authors. The book is From the Moment They Met, It Was Murder, Double Indemnity for and the Rise of Film Noir. It's published by the Running Press. And you can get it. It's available now, isn't it?
No, it's actually delayed a week.
Oh.
You can get it April 2nd.
April 2nd.
Order it now. You can order it now from various sources for delivery on, depends on where you're buying it, the 2nd or the 3rd.
Fantastic. Well, go to Amazon, go to barnesandnoble.com, go to runningpress.com, or go to your brick and mortar store. Order it.
Running Press is a subsidiary of Hachette, and you can find it on the Hachette website.
Fantastic. Well, Alan and James, thanks again for being on Lights, Camera, Author tonight.
Thank
Pleasure
you.
Pleasure to be with you.